Yeah, it's a funny thing. I mean, the book was actually inspired. I mean, I'm connected with Corinthian Casuals. I'm the chairman of the youth section and have been for many years. And got interested in the history of the club and began to do research and what have you. So you know, over the last decade or so, some historians have been taking a cold hard look at Corinthian and so some of them have suggested that the club is not worthy of admiration. They were just you know, a bunch of toffs trying to protect their you know, their game from the working class professionals. One of them, and again, they started to look at Par Jackson as well and found out that he had lied about certain things. So there was this reaction in me, which was like, well, I want to know more about Par Jackson. Very little is known about him, which is one of the reasons why these historians are suspicious. But the idea of pulling the rug under the history of the Corinthians was never my intention, and I don't think I have done. There's the statistics of their performances and their wins against, you know, league and FA Cup winners and such. Those are solidly ground in football history. But whenever the Corinthian story was told or is told, it always begins with Par, and football historians or the history of football, if you read through the numerous volumes that have covered the Corinthians, paint Jackson as a genius, you know, as the founding father of the Corinthians. And so, you know, why these historians were deciding to take the Corinthians to task was one of the reasons why I wanted to have a look at what was going on, and you know, just do some fact checking, some debunking, and you know, that kind of stuff that people do these days. And what I discovered was that all of the histories that have ever been written about the club, even by the club's biographers, and there's been three of those, they've all used a version of the club history that was, should we say, invented by Parr. And that was, you know, to me, that was a little unnerving. And it's not just it doesn't stand up to examination, his claims that he founded the club to improve the quality of English performances against Scotland, because that didn't happen. And it's not the fact that he claimed that with the addition of, you know, numerous Corinthians to the England squad, England's fortunes against Scotland improved. They didn't. You know, this is what he wrote back in the 1890s, and you know, and what he espoused all his life, and it was taken as fact, and no one questioned it. And it was regurgitated by Bertie Corbett, and then by FNS Creek in the history of the Corinthians, and then, you know, more recently by Rob Cavallini in Play Up Corinth, and none of those authors actually questioned what Parr was saying and looked into the authenticity of his claims, and that was, you know, that was that's so, I mean, I guess the bottom line is that a lot of football history has been written by people in the 1880s and 90s and you know, the early part of the last century, and they all seem to have come from the same social background. They were all amateurs. They were all seemed to be all members of the FA, and it made me suggest that maybe the history of football as we know it isn't actually accurate. And maybe it was influenced by those people who were writing the history of football. So, you know, that's a knock on. I don't actually go into that in any depth, because it's a massive subject, and it's really for someone else to do. But the concept that one of the most influential people in the FA in the 1880s decided to enhance his tale, and enhance his place in the story of the Corinthians, I think is newsworthy. I think it's interesting.
And did you reach any conclusions about whether or not his recollections were just inaccurate, or if he out and out lied about some things?
That's a good question. I think it's difficult to use the word lie. It's
Did he
funny that
intend to
we're talking on the
mislead
day that.
people, or did he intend to mislead people, or was he, we see, just remembering things in the way he wanted them to have happened, do you think?
He wrote a story that made him look better than he
Right.
was, that made him more influential. Yeah, which is I guess it's understandable. I mean, for all the bad things about Pa that the book covers, he was the driving force behind the Corinthians. He was the one of the best administrators of the day. He was one of the very early first sports journalists. I mean, if it wasn't for Pa, the Corinthians probably never would have happened. So he's got that credit, but that obviously wasn't enough for him, and he wanted to be seen as the originator, the genius, the founding father, the person behind the success of the Corinthians, and so consequently he tampered with the facts. I think that's probably the nicest way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Corinthians as an idea. This was about a collection of amateur players who were able to kind of come together in a way that would allow them to play better if they represented England. Was that the idea?
Well, the Corinthians, I don't come to any conclusions in the book about why they were founded, other than the fact that they were the next in a series of football clubs or football teams that proposed to play midweek football. It seems at the time in the early 1880s that playing once a week on a Saturday wasn't enough for a lot of footballers, and they wanted more opportunity to play. And the Corinthians were originally called the Wednesday Club, and it was used to attract mostly amateurs, which the South was amateur then, and professionalism was illegal. But the idea of playing midweek football was developed by the original casuals. There's two versions of the casuals. One that was playing in the 1870s, and it had international players and major players from the London clubs would play on a Wednesday there for them. And I think the Corinthians were formed along those lines. But in Parr's version of the story, he identified the fact that Scotland were better at football because most of the team came from Queen's Park. And he peddled this concept that if there was a team in England where the players could get to play together and know each other the way that the Scottish have with Queen's Park, then the English team would become better and be able to match Scotland at their own game. And ultimately, I think that's the story he told. It kind of falls apart when you look at the statistics of the Scottish team, which they weren't always. There were a lot of Queen's Park players, but there weren't as many as he's suggesting. And the addition of Corinthians players, well, Corinthians were formed to allow these players to play together, and the addition of Corinthian players to the England squad didn't significantly improve results against Scotland. They may have done against Wales and Ireland, but they weren't a significant improvement at that time. So, his version of the story is the one that has now gone into football folklore, playing against Scotland, getting England to play together, all a team to allow the England national to play together and then go out and take on the Scots. It doesn't add up, and it's not supported by the facts.
It must have been really challenging to do the research for this book, because you were trying to kind of wade through an awful lot of information from people who'd written the story, I guess, that they wanted to be heard, the one that they wanted to share.
Well, I think that this concept of not letting the truth get in the way of a good story is very much a case of the Corinthians' accepted history. I mean, the idea of identifying that Scotland were better because they played better together because they were all from the same club, and then for building a team off the back of that idea, and then that team going out and proving the concept from the outset, that's a great story. Trouble is, it's untrue.
Where did Pa's interest in sports start? Because he preferred cricket and rugby, didn't he, at the beginning?
That's one thing in the book that I try to cover. There's no real, I can't discover too much about where he got his sporting inspiration from. He wasn't really in a position to join clubs or anything, because he was on the move a lot with his family. He says that he played rugby for 7 years before discovering association football. I can't find any references to him playing rugby. He says a lot of things. He says he founded the Finchley Football Club, which he didn't. It was already there. He just joined it. He said that he influenced the founding of the Lawn Tennis Association as well, which is another what's a fib, should we say? So where he discovered sport, we don't know. I mean, we don't know where he went to school. I think it was probably home tutored. He says he went to Clapham Grammar and potentially Cranbrook, but there's no proof of that at all either. So it's not really clear where he discovered his interest in sport. But when he did discover an interest in it, he became very good at administrating it. And when he got involved with Finchley, he became an astonishing administrator. He managed to, you know, do all the things that an honorary general secretary does, which is they're probably the most important person in any football club. And through his connections with Finchley, he entered the FA, and then he joined this society of the upper middle classes that he aspired to. And he did whatever they wanted. He was very, very good at administrating football, and consequently got the job of on sec of the London Football Association. And of course, he was the secretary of Corinthians. So he is very good at what he did, but he just unfortunately enhanced his story to place him in a much more dominant, influential position than he actually was. I mean, one thing that we have part to thank for is international caps. He was the one that raised this as an FA committee meeting and suggested that the caps should be white with a cross on them, and they were adopted. And it turned out to be they were going to be blue with a white cross or red cross or whatever. But it was Parr's idea. So, you know, he did have an influence on the development of the game in that particular area. He also proposed and supported many changes to the rules in the FA as well. So he is an influential phenomenon, shall we say, but he's also an enigma as well.
Yes, a character. To kind of maybe condense it, he was a journalist as well, and he was an author. I think he was involved in some quite important publications, wasn't he, when it came to football?
Yeah, there's a couple of important books that were published in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s that looked at the game. I mean, the idea behind publishing books about the sport was what has been described as the literaturization of the sport, which means that it has integrity. So, you know, football was it was a very early sport, very 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 young, and for it to be taken seriously, having books written about it gave it some substance and meaning and value. And Charles Alcock, who was Parr's mentor at the FA for many years, he wrote a book called A Football Hour Winter Game, which basically, whether you believe it or not, he looked at the history of pretty much every ball game from the Romans onwards, and managed to link that to football somehow. And it was a very important book, but setting the concept of football as an antiquity, and you know what they were doing was reviving a sport that had been played, you know, for centuries, was important to those who were governing the game. Alcock made money off Parr by renting him an office in Paternoster Square, and then renting an office in Paternoster Row. But yeah, Alcock was highly, highly regarded. He's been described the father of modern sport. I mean, he wasn't just football. He was, you know, I think 35 years he was the honorary secretary of the Surrey Cricket Club, 25 years as a secretary of the FA. So yes, he was an astonishingly influential, and he took Parr on and taught Parr, I suppose, how to be a journalist and how to run business and that kind of stuff. And you know, I think that Parr was extremely lucky. He just seemed to be in the right place at the right time. I mean, Finchley was just a small junior club in London that probably wasn't very exciting to watch, but it was a community club, and we probably got supported quite well. But because Finchley were members of the FA, Parr could attend FA meetings, and he, you know, 18 months after attending his first FA meeting, he's appointed Alcock's assistant, which is again astonishing. He was very lucky, and he landed on his feet with that. But he was also, I mean, some of the things that, you know, the enigma about him was he supported the legitimization of professionalism, and on several occasions was stood up and made speeches in the FA, and finally it was legitimized in 1885. The professionals were allowed to play, but they're closely controlled. And then Parr spent the rest of his 20 years antagonizing the professionals, you know, hating the professionals. It's odd. I mean, he was seen as the father of amateurism, or the champion of amateurism at that time. Once called, you know, professional footballers wretches or poor wretches or something. But then at the same time, he would organize games for Corinthians against their employers. And in fact, the Corinthian games against the top professional sides at that time were the star fixtures of the calendar.
So, I mean, with the Corinthians, what was the appeal in that case of clubs playing them? Why did teams want to play against them? And why did that seem to capture the public's imagination as well?
Well, yeah, that's that. And this is something that they were outstanding at. I mean, you want to remember that the Corinthians were amateurs. They were part-timers. They all had day jobs. Yes, they were all public schoolboys, mostly some of them from university and that kind of stuff. But they played for nothing. They were, you know, it was they were playing for the sheer pleasure of it, for the joy of it. And what you the situation you have is, say, like Corinthians versus Preston North End, who were, you know, the one of the biggest teams of the 1880s, 1890s. You know, those games were much sought after. There's hundreds of thousands, not hundreds, but tens of thousands of people would attend their games. Big rivalry. I mean, Parr and Sudell, William Sudell, who was the manager of Preston at that time, they were friends. And so Corinthians played Preston North End more than any other professional team at that time. But what you had was the appearance of a team of toffs playing a working class team. And, you know, there's the Schadenfreude effect there, isn't there? Most of the people in the crowd at Preston would be working class, and they've come along to see these gentlemen get beaten, which is what they wanted. And more often than not, they were. But occasionally, Corinthians actually held their own and would beat the, you know, these professional teams. I mean, when Parr's third game in charge, when he took over in 1884, the end of 1884. Was against Blackburn Rovers, who had won the FA Cup and would win the FA Cup again the following year, and no one knew who the Corinthians were. They just showed up. You know, they were the posh gentlemen from the south were coming up to play a game, and Corinthians beat the FA Cup holders 8-1. You know, it was an astonishing result. I mean, really, like it's staggering. I mean, no one could make any sense of it. It really put Corinthians on the map and made them very, very newsworthy. But yeah, these amateur gentlemen who play, you know, charity games to raise money for hospitals and such. I mean, I was reading the other day about well, being a West Ham fan. I was looking at the Corinthian history of playing West Ham, and Corinthians played West Ham a couple of times before the First World War. One time to raise money for the West Ham Hospital, and another time to raise money for the West Ham unemployed. And the Corinthians were very welcome in East London because of the style of football they played, that people loved to see attacking football. It was the Corinthian style. And I like to think that fed into the modern day concept of the West Ham style. I mean, we like to see West Ham get forward and play attractive football. And that's what the Corinthians did. And so, you know, this was the same with most clubs across the country. When Corinthians came, they knew they were going to see the best amateur players in the country. They knew they were going to see an exciting attacking game. And so consequently, they were welcomed wherever they went.
It rather demonstrated the commercial appeal, didn't it, of football, which might not have been exactly what Parr Jackson was after.
Well, yeah, I think that it's undeniable, the fact that the bigger the game, the bigger the crowd, the more money is taken at the gates. And that's a dichotomy with the Corinthians. It's difficult to hear them talking about playing for the love of the game, and you know, all being amateurs and not taking any fees or what have you. Yet the gates that they made were enormous. I mean, Parr would arrange guarantees with some of the bigger clubs. One of the most common guarantees was against Queen's Park, because they were the best team in the world, considered to be one of the best teams in the world, and were great friends with the Corinthians. And the New Year's Day, the annual New Year's Day game between Corinthians and Queen's Park, always used to attract, you know, tens of thousands of spectators. And Parr would always ask for a guarantee of, I think, one, off the top of my head, I think once he asked for a guarantee of £75, which is an enormous sum in those days. But that money went towards allowing the Corinthians to tour, to pay their expenses, of course. I mean, you know, going from London to Glasgow is you know, you're taking 14 or 16 people is not cheap. And so, yeah, there is this issue of money, and they were criticised for being all but professionals, but in name, simply because of the money they took in these guarantees and the gate money that they raised. But a lot of the times they also played for absolutely nothing, and they raised money for charities. So, you know, it's a balance. It's difficult to balance the two between the amateurs and the professionals at that time, because the professionals were getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more dominant. And, you know, after the turn of the century, games, you know, amateur games were not seen as the same quality as you know, those cup winning runs that clubs went on in the professional game. So when the period that Parr was in the FA was a period when the amateurs were superseded by the professionals. And by the time Parr left the FA in the end of the 1890s, there was a professional dominance in the FA, and they started to make rules for the professionals, and that's what alienated the amateurs and led to the split in 1906-07. The one thing that I noticed about him, about some of the resolutions that he tried to pass at FA meetings, was he had a deep, really deep and clear understanding of the game. And so when someone would propose a rule that they thought was a good idea, if Parr saw a fault with it, he would stand up and say, no, you can't have that, because this will happen and then this will happen and et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, he was very much there, but guiding the evolution of the rules of the game. But it was that period that he was there that the modern game was born. I mean, when he first joined the FA in 1880, there was not one universal set of rules that everybody abided to across the country. There was different rules for throw-ins, and there was different rules for goals, and you know, even the use of hands in some cases. So you know, by the time he left, there was one rule book and everybody adhered to it. So it was easy to play, you know, easy to understand what the game is. But getting to that point took a lot of people a lot of time to work through each new adaptation or development. And he was part of that. So, you know, you've got to hand Parr credit where credit's due, even though a lot of his later resolutions were intended to reduce the impact of the Scottish professionals who were coming down to play in the North, and to restrict restrict the rise of professionalism that he had supported from the outset. So he's an enigma.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to say, one of the concerns about professionalism was it would lead to foul play. I wonder if that's come to pass.
Yeah, well, it did come to pass. I mean, what happened? There was a period before the First World War where two codes of football were set up. There was the amateur code. They split from the professionals and weren't allowed to play against professional teams, which completely damaged the Corinthians, of course, because that's where they made their money, was playing against professional teams. But when the amateurs left, the straw that broke the camel's back was the introduction of rules by the now by this time professional FA to try and restrict fouling on the pitch, and you know, this kind of trying to get an unfair advantage. Like today we would call it gamesmanship or anything like that, but to the amateurs who were born and brought up or educated to be honourable gentlemen, the idea of purposely fouling someone was an enigma. It was against their own, you know, their own personal code, and so it being told by the FA that they, you know, that they were going to start be giving free kicks and penalties because of, you know, a foul play or purposeful foul play, it just was enough. The amateurs said, you know, I don't want someone to be the arbiter of my honor, you know, as the referee would become. I will not do this, but so I don't really need you to tell me how to behave on a football pitch, because it's, you know, it's part of my code as a gentleman. And so they had enough, and they walked out and they split. Yeah, so it was a very strange period in football history, that 1906 to just before the First World War, when amateurs played their games against each other and the professionals played their games against each other, and never the twain should meet, which, like I say, was destroyed Corinthians. And a lot of Corinthians were behind the split, but it destroyed them. It prevented them from doing what they were supposed to do, you know, to enhance their reputation by continuing to play and potentially defeat these top professional sides to prove the amateurs are still, you know, are still competitive. But the upside of it was that the Corinthians, instead of looking to try and play in you know, games in England or Britain, they looked abroad and they went to Brazil. And in some of those visits to the other countries, well, in Brazil, gave birth to the Corinthian Paulista, who took their name and were inspired by their play. But they went around Europe and the world, introducing the game to you know, new countries. Some countries would later become footballing superpowers. They'd beat national sides. Corinthians, you know, I think they beat Belgium 12-0, which is, you know, an interesting score compared to what would happen today. But yeah, so, you know, the split destroyed the Corinthians. It was the worst mistake they ever made. I mean, that's one of the things that I've always admired about the Corinthians is the aspect of playing football, being honourable. You know, fair play and sportsmanship—that's the Corinthian spirit. That's something that we still teach or coach in our teams in this club. The idea that winning isn't everything—it's, you know, it's how you play. I mean, winning's great, but learning how to lose as well is really important for a young player coming through. And so, you know, gamesmanship and stuff—we see in the Premiership. It's emulated by some of the kids, and they need to know that some of it is not correct. You know, the idea of playing for honour, playing for the shirt or whatever is really important in a footballer's development. You know, if they think that they're just playing football and they're going to train and work as hard as they can because they want to be professionals one day and et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's a bubble that needs to be burst early on. You know, the idea of coaching kids to enjoy what they do on a football pitch is so important, and it's such a Corinthian thing as well. It's such a Corinthian spirit. So, you know, that's, again, I think is the legacy. One of Pa's legacies is this concept of the Corinthian spirit, although he wasn't very good at upholding it himself. The players were.
What led to him sort of walking away from football, falling out with the game and with the organisations that were looking after it?
Yeah, well, for Parr, I think that he realised that he'd sided with the wrong people. I think at some point he became more and more outspoken about professionalism and upset an awful lot of people. And when the secretary of the London FA, the FA introduced a rule saying that you've got to allow professionals to play in your leagues. And Parr was totally against it and was furious. And then when Arsenal said they were turning professional, they resigned from the FA, but that didn't stop Parr from organizing a boycott of Arsenal. And he had to give way on that. But the final straw for him was when the FA introduced a rule that said, if you're fielding a scratch 11, which is what I think the Corinthians were, the greatest scratch 11 of all time. Now, this is a team that, this is a game or a fixture that would be played for charity, or you know, for Corinthians would play against anybody. They were considered a scratch team, and the ruling said that scratch teams had to get permission from their local football association before they could play any games. And the reason behind it was there had been some scratch teams that had been making money out of it. They'd get together a handful of half decent players, and they'd play a professional club, and they'd make some money out of it. And that needed to be controlled somewhat. But the thing was is that it also affected Corinthians, who you know had such a reputation. And Parr felt it was besmirching his reputation. So he arranged a couple of games against one against Oxford University, one against Cambridge. Ignored the rules and then got dragged in front of the FA, accused of disloyalty and bad sportsmanship. And ultimately, after several months of bickering, he said, "Oh, I've had enough of this," and he walked out, and that was it. He was gone.
We've barely scratched the surface of, I suppose, turning his attention to golf and then tennis, as you say. The formation of the LTA. How hands-on was he with that or not?
Yeah, well, Wikipedia probably won't mention him as being part of that. But as part of his publishing business, he partnered with Julian Marshall, who was the president or the secretary of the All England Lawn Tennis Association, which was the governing body of lawn tennis at that time. And they published a weekly magazine called Pastime. And Parr was involved he was a judge. He became a referee for lawn tennis and was highly sought after and acted as umpire in numerous tournaments. Bearing in mind that tennis was only a decade old at this time, or maybe a bit more, it was a new sport coming through, and I think Parr thought that he could get involved in it, and you know it could be quite lucrative for him. Consequently, the Pastime, which focused on rackets and tennis and lawn tennis and what have you. And in his autobiography, he says that he was working in the background to make sure that the All England Lawn Tennis Association, which was the unelected governing body, should be replaced by an elected governing body made up of those organisations who belong to it. And I can understand why he didn't want to have his name associated with what turned out to be a rebellion, because it made him look like he was working against his partner in the magazine. But eventually, the Lawn Tennis Association was set up, and he was there when it was set up. And he was an influencer, maybe, but he wasn't the founder of it, as he later claimed.
His obituary, I think, among other things, he was described as the grand old man of British sports. Would that be a fair?
Yeah, well, that's how he was seen across the world. I mean, when he died, obituaries appeared from Australia to America. Then he was considered the grand old man of sport, a title that he had built for himself, he'd say over the years he'd done this and he'd done that, and it all became part of his profile, very carefully crafted and very well crafted. So yes, when he died, he was looked at as the grand old man of Victorian and Edwardian sport. Whether or not he deserved that title, I don't know, but it was a profile, a facade that he created, and it stuck.
A great story, whichever bits of it are true or not.
Yeah, I think it's a good story. I mean, there's aspects of why his story is so interesting that have led to the reassessment of other areas of the Corinthians as well, the name Corinthians has been used against them by a lot of the revisionist historians because it indicates or it suggests elitism, And this is one of the things that the Corinthians have been criticized of. You know, only those who are the best can go to Corinth, kind of deal. And in reality, it was taken from Henry V, where he describes himself as a Corinthian and a man of metal. And that's not something that's ever been talked about before, as far as I'm aware, as part of the history of the club. So discovering certain aspects of the club and putting them in place is quite satisfying. And I'm glad that the elitist thing can be dropped now, because that I don't believe they were elitist. I believe that they were members of a certain class. But I don't think they were trying to protect it from the working class professionals. I think they really did just enjoy playing football, and they got very good at it. I mean, they were, you know, most of them, like I say, university types who could spend a lot of time training and getting better at their game. And to see them go out, you know, hammer and tongs against an FA Cup winning side must have been a wonderful spectacle.
This book must have seen you sift through all sorts of inconsistencies, inaccuracies, downright fibs, as we've used that word earlier in this interview. I just wonder how close you hope that you've got to the truth in this book.
Oh God, I think you can only scratch the surface. I mean, like I said at the outset, the history of the early years of football, the history of the early years of football was written by a small group of self-interested types who saw what was happening in their game and disregarded what was happening elsewhere, or not disregarded, or weren't aware of what was happening elsewhere, like in Scotland. I mean, there's a big argument to say that Scotland had more influence on the development of the game than any other country, yet England always says that, you know, football's coming home. And in a sense, I think that needs to be looked at, academically.
Do you think when it comes to Parr Jackson, you've gone some way to writing a slightly more honest account of his life and his influence?
I hope so. I really do, because, you know, he is a character. And very little was known about him. And I hope that I've managed to identify the motivating forces within him that made him do what he did, and how he managed to achieve what he achieved. You cannot take away from him the fact that it was, you know, the Corinthians would not be the Corinthians without Parr Jackson. But then rewriting the story to make himself look the central character, is that unforgivable? I don't know. Again, I go back to that word enigma. I like to think that the book explains, his biography explains why he became what he became.